He won't pick up the check. She won't go to bed with you. The morning kisses just before work stopped months ago, and you fear that there might be an end to this crazy little thing called a relationship. He once offered flowers. Now he cleans the toilet every 3 months, and that's if you're lucky. She began replacing loving words with vile sentences in which she finally confessed how much of a spiteful ingrate you are. But that didn't hurt nearly as much as the time when she jumped up and down on your heart with a painful pair of stilettos. These are the things that sometimes pass for love. Okay, so I am here with Allison Amond, who is the author of Things That Pass for Love. Allison, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Well, first off, I wanted to talk about golf. Golf figures prominently into a number of these stories, and in How Much Greater the Miracle, you write, "The soul and golf are interrelated. I try not to wax too philosophical, but the soul is like a golf ball." Now, is this particular statement one of the reasons you frequently return to golf in your writing? Do you feel that golf gets a bad rap? Is this your way of essentially taking it or absconding it from the upper-class country club associations? Are you trying to counter the John Updike, Richard Ford, Kevin Costner kind of approach to golf? I think this is a very important question.
I think that your answer is much better than the one I'm going to give you.
No, I'm sure your answer is going to be fantastic.
Which is that back when I was in grad school, Michael Curtis, who edits the fiction for the Atlantic Monthly, requested some golf stories. He was editing the fiction section of Golf Digest and needed some like golf stories. So I was like, I can write a golf story. So I wrote a golf story, and he said, "Oh, it's very good. I don't want it, but it's a good story." And I said, "Thank you." And I said, "Well, I'll write another one." So I wrote another golf story, and he said, "I don't want this one either, but but I like your writing." And so I wrote one more just to see. I do really like golf as a literary theme because, first of all, it's something for your characters to do without really actually having to have them do a lot of business, right? Yeah. Everyone knows how you play. I mean, everyone knows sort of the theory of golf. You hit a ball towards a hole, you know? And so your characters can talk a lot and can think about things without, you know, having to... It's not like it's a basketball where you have to describe the action all the time.
Yeah.
So I really like golf that way. And also, it's this really absurd game. I played a lot when I was younger and don't play so much now, but... you know, if you told me, you know, you can't see there's a hole about the size of your palm, you know, and you can't see it from here, but if you hit the ball 3 times, you'll get it in the hole.
No,
I would never have believed it. So
you say that you had golf experience before when you had been asked to do these stories, or did you have to kind of go into golf again and kind of do a sort of... a refresher course, so to speak, or a refresher run? Or?
Well, I was at Iowa. We had a lot of free time.
Okay. They have golf in Iowa.
They do have golf in Iowa, actually, and it's actually pretty accessible. There was a great municipal golf course, a 9-hole golf course, and so I actually played a decent amount of golf, but mostly I just asked my parents. They are very into golf, and so when I needed some golf details to make the story seem more authentic, I just asked them. I said, you know, what do you do if the ball's on the side of a hill? And my dad's like, well, you hit down on it, obviously. I'm like, oh, of course, yeah. I'm taking notes as I talk to them, yeah. So that was sort of my golf experience.
But this is an interesting notion of what a golf story is, because if one plays golf, it's automatically a golf story, or golf happens to be a motif. I mean, you know, how golf intensive does a golf story have to be?
You know, I don't know. I don't think golf story is like going to be the next hot genre. Although there's the golf novel that does pretty well apparently every year. But for me, it's just a story where I have to ask my parents a lot of questions about golf to write it. That's a golf story.
I'm just wondering if there's any particular golf criteria for a golf story. I've never been asked to write a golf story, and I actually never considered until we just talked about this subject about what a golf story entails. And so I'm wondering, maybe it's like a Christmas story, you know?
It happens to be set at Christmas.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think so. I mean, I'm not sure I'm the best person to ask since none of my golf stories were accepted for Golf Digest.
But they're in here. There's like 3 golf stories
But they're in there, yeah. In which case, golf is just sort of
so
a
So you
theme.
Are a golf story person.
Apparently, I'm a golf story person.
Okay. Yes. Among many other things.
Well, I could be. I've been called worse. So,
Has miniature golf ever occurred to you? I don't know why I'm hung up on the golf thing.
No, it's okay. I'm quite happy to talk about it. Miniature golf. No, you know, actually, that's a great idea for a story. I mean, it would be a really great idea to sort of link a bunch of stories around the theme of golf. But I think I'm kind of a little bit golfed out in the sense that I've sort of said what I have to say about golf, and I've written what I want to write about the kind of people who play golf. But that doesn't mean that I won't revisit golf later and...
Oh, yeah.
In my golfing
life. One
can
OD on golf.
It's true.
Particularly as a fiction writer.
Apparently not my parents. Not my parents can't do so. But I, as a fiction writer writing about it, I can OD on it.
Well, we'll move on to another subject. But, I wanted to ask about many of the Jewish themes that crop up in these particular stories. One common theme on this subject involves Jewishness.
Mm-hmm.
Jewish.
Easy for you to say.
Jewishness in relation to language. I normally say it better.
Yeah.
But in the Janus Gate, you have Janice, a Jewish girl from Allentown, attempting to learn the finer points of Roman tongues. And of course, in the first story, Dominion Over Every Erring Thing, the protagonist is enrolled in a Hebrew school.
Mm-hmm.
And this is interesting to me because it's almost as if this concern for identity and how language relates to it almost compels you to write stories across the spectrum. I'm wondering if this fixation upon Jewishness really permits you to, and language in particular, I wanted to ask you a little bit about this and how it relates to your writing and how it relates to sustaining a narrative.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I like to write about ideas of faith.
Yeah.
In my, there's a lot of stories that deal with faith in various incarnations, and the faith with which I'm most familiar is Judaism. I'm not a particularly spiritual person, but
yeah.
You know, I did go to Hebrew school, and so I feel like when my characters are grappling with issues of faith, they tend to grapple with Judaism. I don't feel like I'm well-versed enough in other religions to have a character be questioning his or her faith in those religions. But they also question their faith in, you know, the institution of marriage. They question their faith in humanity. So I think it's faith is sort of a larger theme than that. And in terms of how that relates to language, I speak a lot of languages. I really love learning languages. I'm always, you know, enrolled in some sort of language class.
Right.
And so I think a lot of people looking for language help is just comes from my life and my interest. But also I think it's fascinating to figure out who you are in other languages. You know, I'm a slightly different person in Spanish than I'm in English. I'm a different person in Italian, a different person in French. Part of it's that I don't have the vocabulary available to me that I do in English because I'm a native English speaker. And part of it's just that the way the language works, you're sort of forced to switch your logic around a little bit. And these are all Romance languages. I can only imagine. I don't speak Chinese well enough yet to be a person in Chinese at all. You know.
Ao hei, any mei, languages lei, ude, uye, pixe.
Six. Five?
Six?
Five, six. Five.
Okay.
Five decently, yeah. So.
And Pig Latin, too.
And Pig Latin, yeah. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So that's sort of my interest in languages. And for a while, beginning sort of my grad school career, I was very interested in stories that were based on language. And they were sort of more overtly experimental stories where language was the sort of the jumping off point for the entire narrative. There was one that I did about, I wrote about a story about Samuel Beckett's daughter and all the... You know, the jumping off points were words that she would get confused. And then, of course, you know, the story is like the Janus Gate, which has as its theme sort of these words that can be read two different ways.
That's interesting because, I mean, in the first story, you don't actually have Hebrew transcribed. It's transcribed, essentially, translated into English.
Yeah.
And that, to me, was a very interesting choice on your part. So I'm curious how this interest in language or other languages causes you to focus more on, I suppose, different tongues within English, within different vernaculars and the like.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting to me when you translate a word into another language, and then that word takes on new meanings or a different meaning. You know, so the idea of I'm just like a silly one, like the molest, right?
Yeah.
Which is to bother, right? But in English, it has this, you know, much worse connotation of a sort of a sexual
wonderfully
assault.
Connotation,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it really lacks that in other languages, and so. The way words have nuances within their surroundings, and if you take them out of the surroundings, what those nuances, what remains, what doesn't remain, those are sort of interesting to me. In terms of why there's no Hebrew in that first story, because I actually don't actually speak Hebrew.
Oh, okay.
But I wanted that sort of stilted, translated
yeah.
feeling to the language, so I just made up stilted, translated English.
I see,
yeah,
I see. So. Well, that's interesting. Also, I wanted to ask you about the first two stories and the theme of small animals, whether they are mice or hamsters who are trying to escape from various cages and the like, and sometimes are let loose by other characters. But this is interesting to me because the animals in these stories reflect the protagonists to a large degree. I mean, the protagonists are trying to come to terms with their particular identity. They are perhaps viewing themselves as smaller than they really are. And this leads me to ask you about how these animals represent a kind of metaphor to a large degree that offers a parallel image of mm-hmm. these particular characters. I'm wondering, when a metaphor like this enters into a story? Does it enter into the revision stage? Is it there all along and that you're kind of wrestling with your subconscious in order to figure out where a particular story is going? And particularly Small Animals, these aren't the only two stories in which Small Animals factor in. And I like Small Animals, and these are, you know, they really are the underdog animals in these stories. So what of this grand dilemma?
I'm surprised the ASPCA hasn't called me and complained about the animal violence in my books. What are the small animals? Well, I think actually in terms of being overt metaphors, I don't really realize that that's happening until sort of afterwards. And one of the most fascinating things about this book tour has been I've visited a couple book clubs and a couple of classes and hearing, you know, these interpretations of my story, which when I hear them, I'm like, oh, of course that's what's going on. But I hadn't sort of necessarily overtly planned it that way. But I think that's definitely a valid point, that these are sort of stand-ins for people. I like animals and stories because I feel like it's a sort of a less explored trope than like kids. Often kids are in stories and it's too cute now. You can, even though I have a lot of children in my stories, but you don't want to have, you know, the idea of the child as the font of all wisdom or the, you know, the deaf person as the font of all wisdom. And I think I wanted to sort of move beyond that. And so, you know, in some ways, animals are the source of knowledge for these people. But animals, you know, these animals anyway, have no knowledge. So what it is, it's the person, the character sort of projecting onto the animal, like you said, what he or she is feeling. I also like, this is going to sound terrible, I was about to say I like killing animals. But I like, you know, when animals die in fiction because it, you're not manipulating the reader then. Obviously, nobody wants to read about a dead mouse, but at the same time, like, it's not a tragedy. You're not manipulating a reader with a dead child or, you know, or a major illness. And so I feel like it's, you can get it sort of the emotional response without really sort of, you know, gimmicking the reader into it. So,
but manipulating the reader, I mean, should you even be concerned about that? I mean, the story is a story and bad things are going to happen. Yes, they may be misconstrued as manipulation by particular critics, but why should the audience matter? Why should the notion of manipulation matter?
I have felt manipulated as a reader by authors sometimes, especially when, you know, characters die. And I sometimes it obviously has to happen for the story, but sometimes it also just seems very convenient way to ratchet up the emotional level of the story. And I don't want to do anything necessarily for convenience's sake. So I would rather have the emotion come from a genuine situation in the story than from a particular plot point that's sort of, you know, universally, you know, brings tears to our eyes. Which isn't to say that, you know, no one should ever die in fiction. I mean, fiction deals with what happens in the world, and people die in the world.
Yeah.
What I don't like is when these quote unquote tragic situations are used to, you know, get the reader in an emotional state, so that the rest of the story seems more important. You know, when those actions arise from the situation, then I think they're valid. When you're just trying to get somebody all worked up so that they feel care more about this character, I think that's not a great way to go about it.
But isn't this a concern for all fiction in general? Because you have to relate to an audience, you have to get a reader to empathize with a particular character, and as such, I suppose, there's a certain amount of manipulation you can't avoid. I mean, maybe it's a matter of not being conscious or giving yourself permission to just write with your blinders on, or, you know, and just go ahead and not even think about these particular things. I mean, that's why I raised the question of whether it really is manipulation, because a story is a narrative, and a narrative deals with a sequence of events, and as such, well, you know, it's going to involve some kind of manipulation because you're arranging a series of events. I don't know if it's necessarily a fair point on your end.
No, well, I would say there's definitely a line between wanting to place a point of identification for a reader so that you create either a character situation with which the reader can identify and thereby give them a connection to the story versus, you know, really trying to grab them by the beard and pull them into the story by providing that emotional
connection. You want to grab my beard, that's what you're
saying. Well, that's why I'm looking at you and I'm saying beard. I'm like, oh, I was grabbed by the shirt. I'm like, but look, that beard is so much
you can grab me by the shirt and the beard.
Yeah. You know, and to pull them into the story. I would rather have them identify with a, you know, a character, an emotion, or a situation than with sort of a larger... And I think that's... you know, what I'm looking for in my fiction is to get, I mean, what everyone's looking for if they're, you know, working on their writing, is to get beyond the general into the specific, get beyond, you know, the things that we all know about the world to something a little bit more hidden about the world, a little more hidden about character or human nature. And that, you know, as I work on my writing and develop it, that's what I'm trying to do more of, to, you know, go beyond surface descriptions and really get into the heart of the matter.
But this goes back to my question earlier about the animals as a metaphor.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, it seems to me that you're essentially laying down a whole bunch of themes or language or symbols or whatnot,
mm-hmm.
And you're essentially writing and giving yourself permission to write about pretty much anything,
mm-hmm.
being unfettered and the like. I'm wondering, how much do you discover in the rewriting of stories? Like, oh, okay, I now know what that is and how that connects to this, and oh, well, that's probably where my story is. How much of your stories are discovered through the act of, I suppose, figuring out what your subconscious is spilling out onto the page?
All of them. And I think all the good ones, anyway. I think there's some ones that, even in the collection that function on, that are, you know, are good stories, but they're not fantastic stories. And I think that's because I approach them wanting to say something as opposed to, like, wanting to write or wanting to write about a character. But I almost think, you know, as I hear you talk about the stories now, I'm like, you know, I'm able to grab onto that theme and be like, that's of course what I was doing. But even in the rewriting process, and I'm not trying to, you know, fake naivete here, but even in the rewriting, I'm not sure I could ever tell you what this story is about in the way that you just told me what those stories were about.
Yeah,
you
sure.
know, things feel like they're in the right place, they're in the wrong place, that they explain too much, that there's not enough explained. Characters feel, you know, undeveloped to me or overly described, but they don't necessarily, I'm not able to say, like, oh, it needs more gerbil, you know? Yeah, this needs more gerbil. And, when the guinea pig appeared in that first story, I was as surprised as, you know, all of a sudden the character asked for a guinea pig for her class, and then I was like, oh, looks like there's going to be a guinea pig in the story. And the reason that came about was what would be, you know, she's grappling with this horrible problem of her class and you know, the fact that the background is that their body's falling from the sky and their class is, fifth graders is completely inured to it. And, you know, what would be, she keeps grasping at these ways to deal with that problem, and the only thing she can come up with is a guinea pig, which is, of course, an incredibly inadequate way to deal with the problem. And although it does actually lead to catharsis, so, you know, so it turns out it's not a horrible way to deal with it, yeah.
Sure. Well, this is interesting because it leads me into a question about whether verisimilitude is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've written a number of stories from male perspectives, from perspectives that are run counter to your innate perspective. And this leads me to ask, when you approach these particular tales that are like a Vietnam veteran or whatnot,
yeah.
Whether this is something that in which, well, do you think the idea that a story needs to be predicated on reality is a little bit of an overstated aspect of what fiction needs to be? And going back to what we're talking about in terms of, well, you're generating this world of subconscious things that are picked up by the reader, well, how does this idea or how does your particular approach of verisimilitude relate to this reader response of being able to interpret a story in manyfold ways?
That's an excellent question. I think in terms of, you know, there's the old adage, write what you know.
Yeah.
And if I'd done that, my stories would all be about, 20, 30-somethings who live in a city and, you know, like go to the gym a lot. So that's not particularly interesting for fiction. But what does work is write what you know in terms of write what you know about people, right? So, you know, I'm not a Vietnam veteran. You know, this is quite shocking to hear. And I actually don't even really know that many Vietnam veterans, but what I do know is people, you know, people, and what I can imagine is people who are in his situation. So I don't see myself ever being able to write a story that takes place in Vietnam, but I might be able to imagine the mindset of someone who'd been there and is now in a place where where I'm slightly more familiar with. And in terms of, while I was putting this collection together, I was teaching a class in magical realism. And I wouldn't really call my stories magical realists. They don't necessarily have anything magical happening, but they are sort of absurdly
yeah.
real, right? Things are plausible but unlikely in a lot of the cases. And I really like that. I think that that's, there's no reason that we're all living on this planet. There's no reason we have to read on this planet also, you know?
Sure.
In that case, in that sense, I do like to have unusual things happen. And it gives you a lot more freedom because you can, you know, to have all of a sudden a body appearing, you know, falling from the sky, that is a way to really sort of get at some more intricate situations and emotions than if it's just a regular story.
But I actually have a theory here relating to the people you know best.
Yes.
I mean, here's a story that wrangles a number of different themes. You've got an erotica writer. You've got a man who men who just simply can't pay attention to what's going on. And all of these particular themes in this story disguise what the story is really about, and that is about an issue that is rarely discussed, I think, in fiction and in newspapers in general, the notion of a smart or misunderstood woman who is simply not getting the romantic attention that she desires and that nobody can, and this is particularly in New York.
Yeah.
I mean, you see this quite a lot.
Yeah.
So this leads me to ask whether, for example, a body falling out of a plane, or in this particular story, all these various elements are there to disguise what may, in fact, really be the thrust of these particular stories, which is something you may know, and the like.
Well, I wouldn't purposefully obfuscate a theme if I knew it were there. Otherwise, I'd write poetry. Sorry, poets. And actually, I don't think that necessarily that these other elements mask what the story is about.
Yeah.
I would say they add to sort of the reader's understanding of what the situation is. You know, so that all these things that appear in that story that you were talking about are things that are going on within the character's, you know, conscious and unconscious mind that then sort of help give an understanding of this character. You know, and to me, actually, I would say the theme of that story is even a little bit bigger, and that's the story I've written most recently. So I feel like I have sort of more of a grasp of what I was trying to say in that story. You know, and that just the idea of loneliness and of misreading other people because you want to assuage your loneliness so much.
Yeah.
So not necessarily, you know. Well, I feel like it looks like a story about a woman who's looking for a boyfriend. To me, it's really a story about when the love relationships you're counting on in your life, like i.e. her relationship with her dog,
when those
fall apart, what do you do? And the idea of, you know, traditionally, I mean, we always talk about sex as being, you know, intimate and shared between two people. And in this case, you know, the sex that she experienced, I mean, she writes about it and it's completely invented and it's between her and, you know, several thousand readers.
Yeah.
So it's really not serving its intended purpose at all.
I'm not suggesting that these particular themes obfuscate the mm-hmm. primary thrust of the story. But what I am suggesting is that by introducing many of these themes, you're essentially presenting a number of arrowheads that point to, here's what the story's really about. It's also a way of avoiding any particular dreaded chiclet label or, you know, this story is really just some trifling kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that is really now what it takes, particularly as a woman writer, to really get this literary credibility. If you write about anything that involves relationships, suddenly it's chick lit these days. It really pisses me off because a man can go ahead and do the same thing and not get nearly this kind of rap.
No, then it's high fidelity when a man
exactly,
does it, right? Yeah,
exactly.
And that's actually, a bunch of my friends were in an anthology called This Is Not Chick Lit.
Yes.
So, yes, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And I that really pisses me off too as well. I would have
I
to say that you can't write about, you know, although I think, you know, chick lit actually is it should be its own separate genre. You know, it's akin to the romance and novel, but it's slightly different. But yeah, but then the line sort of blurs. You take something like Bridget Jones's Diary, which was actually literary fiction in England, and chick lit here, you know, and in some ways it comes down to sort of the marketing of it. And people have sort of decided that if you label a chick lit, you sell a lot of books, you know.
Well,
which
covers
I would not mind, you know, selling a few thousand copies either, you know. But I think there is, and I've certainly wanted to write about, you know, romantic relationships and resisted that impulse because I don't want to write another story about, you know, a single woman in the city looking for love.
Well, what's wrong with that? And particularly if you have many other elements going on. I mean, I don't necessarily believe that chick lit is necessarily bad. And I'm a guy who reads across genres. I read the books with the pink covers. I read science fiction. I read mysteries. I read everything.
Yeah.
And I, it's fiction as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure if it's necessarily a question of marketability. I think it's more of a question also of, well, women writers can write in certain topics, and they can then be declared literary.
Right.
But if they stray from that those particular lines, suddenly, you know, if you look at Curtis Sittenfeld, for example.
Right, yeah.
I mean, she came up with this idea of writing a kind of literary novel about relationships and the like,
yep.
Immediately pegged chick lit, and she then turns around, understandably pissed off, and this becomes an unfortunate scenario, and now she tries to get this literary respectability to varying degrees with this last book, you know?
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, I think ultimately it comes down to is it well written or not? You know, is it deeply imagined or not? And but I agree, it's not fair. There's a double standard, which shouldn't be surprising. There's a lot of double standards that women have to deal with in the world. So that's not too surprising. And I do think, I mean, I know a lot of single women looking for love. So why shouldn't we be able to write about that? But by the same token, you know, when a theme is explored so much in mainstream culture, it's less interesting to me to write about because I feel like it's being treated, you know, pretty fully already. And so I would rather explore something slightly more unexamined. Not that there's anything new left. There's nothing left to write about that's new, but there are things that are, you know, that are more explored and less explored. And so that's why I sort of stay away from, you know, the quote-unquote, like, you know, the chick-lit story. Although my first novel was about a single mother. It lives under my bed now in a box.
Yeah, I know. There's two novels that you wrote. I read your Glimmer Train essay.
Yeah, yeah.
What happened here? You I presume you have an agent.
Yes, I did have... I've had several agents, actually.
really?
Yes.
How many?
I think I've had... 4 official agents and 2 unofficial ones.
Wow. Were they like sub-agents or were they agents that were there to kind of, hey, my current agent is not quite doing the job. Can you help me out?
These were agents I had when I actually didn't have anything to sell. But so, I mean, they were my agent, but they weren't actually doing any agenting because I had nothing that was sellable at the time. And both these novels have gone out and been sent out by agents to look for publishers, and both of them have been almost published a bunch of times.
What happened in these cases?
Maybe they weren't good enough. I don't know. It's hard to say. You know, the second novel I wrote is a difficult novel. It's about Jewish immigrants in Oklahoma in the 1800s, and it is not necessarily an easy read. Getting back to the theme, I was called in for a meeting with a top editor at Random House, and she loved the book, and, you know, would it be possible to include a love story in the second part? And wouldn't I really rather have a female protagonist? Because the male protagonist is, you know, not as appealing to people who buy books.
Yeah.
And honestly, I thought about it. Like, I really wanted to sell this book. I really wanted to tell this story. You know, would this be possible? And I sort of outlined a scenario in which I could give her more of what she wanted. And then she said, you know, well, I really can't buy it until I see what you've written. And I thought to myself, you know what, I like the book the way it is. And if somebody bought it and wanted to change it with me, then fine. But I'm not going to change it because someone might want to see something else. You
it's
know,
like
you
writing on spec, basically.
It was like writing, which is what we do with fiction, right?
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
You know, this also at the same time, you know, it's like you can't pick up a biography of Lincoln and complain because Madonna's not in it, you know. And I felt like that's sort of what she was doing. She was picking up this book, which is about, you know, 3 generations of men in, you know, pre-statehood Oklahoma, and she really wanted it to be about women or have it be a love story. And that's just not the book it was. So.
Yeah.
And in terms of, you know, when you get things back from editors, the things come back with editor speak. Like, I just didn't connect with the characters. I just didn't fall in love. And that may actually mean that they didn't connect with the characters. They just didn't fall in love. It may mean that they already had a book that they, you know, pushed to the editorial committee and they don't feel like they have enough clout right now to push another one. Or there might be another book about Oklahoma on their list this year. You know, you never know sort of what's really going on at a
There's more luck involved, it seems, in this novel writing scenario than there is perhaps in short stories, which has, I suppose, more freedom, even though it's more difficult to sell a short story collection.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, if it depends, you know, why you're writing. Are you writing to get, you know, your book published? And obviously that's the goal. Otherwise, why would we not just imagine these things? Why do we set them on paper? But, you know, if you want to be writing literary fiction as opposed to commercial fiction, you know, then you have to be willing to hear no a lot, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this Random House editor, I mean, here we have the publishing industry in a certain free fall right now.
Yes.
Hopefully things will pick up eventually in a few months, but it's pretty grim with layoffs all across the board. I mean, and this leads me to ask, well, is a certain amount of compromise necessary? Can you be true to your voice if they want the, you know, the romantic subplot or whatnot? Or is this just really not possible for you?
It's kind of not possible in the sense that, you know, if you're writing someone else's specifications, the book won't feel real.
Yeah.
You know, if you're writing what somebody else wants, it's not going to feel authentic. And then it's not going to be good because it's not, you're not going to let the characters do what they want to do. You're not going to let the story tell what it wants to tell. You know, that being said, I'm not so, you know, am I such like an artistic high horse that I wouldn't be happy to make some changes should anyone express interest in, you know, and I always listen to editors because I mean, editors are really, they're fantastic readers. They do it out of love. I mean, there are very few editors, you know, like driving Bentleys around Manhattan, you know, and they're trying to make the story better. So, or the novel better. And so I always listen very, very carefully. But ultimately, if I don't think it's a good idea what they're proposing, then I could physically change the book, but it's just, it's not going to read like a true book. It's not going to be as affecting because it's not something I believe in.
Yeah, but this is interesting in light of what we were talking about earlier about the notion of verisimilitude and about how you are essentially writing and giving, and you can't necessarily think about this notion of manipulation or contrivances. Yeah. So how do you reconcile what you said earlier with what you're saying now?
I actually don't think that there necessarily even need reconciliation, that you have to, you know, you have to sort of write what wants to be written in a sort of way, you know, as opposed to writing what you think will sell or what somebody else will want. And I think that actually sort of is the same thing I was saying earlier in the sense that, you know, you need to write sort of what comes to your mind and sort of figure out what you're trying to say afterwards, you know, if at all. I mean, sometimes you don't even necessarily need to say sort of what, you know, necessarily a short story is about or what you're trying to go for.
Got it. I have to ask you about Zima, because it appears in three of the stories in here.
Does it really?
Yes, it does. It's described at one point, you reference, and then there was Claire, you reference an enormous lit plastic advertisement in the shape of a bottle of Zima. Now, when a thing appears three times, I do have to ask the author about it. So what of this Zima? I mean, as you know, Zima is no longer around, or it's actually in short supply. Coors has stopped restocking it.
I mean,
Zima's a pretty terrible liquor. I mean, an alcohol pop that's just flavorless.
Yeah, I would call that a little bit lazy writing on my part. I would cop to some lazy writing in the sense that Zima, you know, we used to like occasionally drink it in college, and even in college we didn't really drink it because it was, you know, it's such a quote-unquote girly drink that, you know, no one would ever drink it. So to me it represents like really crappy booze. That
it was either Zima or Long Island iced tea.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, it's sort of the same. So, but you know, and as I went through the collection, these stories were written over 10 years.
Yeah.
And as I went through the collection, I tried to get rid of a lot of that. Have you noticed there are a lot of strobe lights in the collection, too?
Yeah.
Yeah, I tried to get rid of those, too.
But three times, that's pretty significant. I mean, obviously it made an impression, Zima. You know?
Yeah, it's literary shorthand. It's shorthand for crappy booze. And, you know, and I feel like, you know, when I reprint this collection, when it goes double platinum and I reprint it, I will certainly Long Island iced tea for one of those.
Wait a second here. I mean, you know, you are under a certain obligation, seeing as how Zima is becoming extinct, to provide for future readers a notion of crappy booze that was imbibed during the last 10 years. So I would argue that you should keep those particular references in there.
Maybe not all three.
You have a duty
maybe
to do
two,
that.
Maybe two. Maybe two, yeah.
Okay.
But also, actually, I was talking about this last night. I was at a reading last night, and a friend of mine who's a painter, not even particularly a reader, was saying that, you know, that he doesn't like it when they have sort of pop culture references in modern fiction, contemporary fiction, because he feels like it's not going to be around or it's not going to be understood in 75 years. And he said, you know, name a book from the canon that has pop culture references. And I'm sure there are a few, but I couldn't.
Oh, Henry.
Yeah?
There's Guinness and James Joyce. There's Budweiser. And obviously, I'm paying attention to the
booze.
Brand.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
I can assure you that that's the case.
Okay. Then good. Then I don't feel so bad about the Zima. All right, I'm keeping the Zima.
Look through Somerset Maugham stories. You'll find all kinds of cigarette brand names. I mean, you know, it's this is just a part of our culture.
Yeah. This is. I would say that's sort of toward the more modern end of it, though. I mean, you don't see pop culture in, you know, in Balzac. You don't see, I guess, because it really wasn't, I guess,
Dickens
as popular culture.
Too.
Dickens had Guinness?
I remember. I can't remember which one it was. I remember I saw Dickens having Guinness.
I know. I love Dickens. Yeah.
Now, I guess it's been around a while.
Okay,
so.
Good. Then I'm not going to feel so bad about the Zima.
Yeah, I'm trying to say this, you know.
Keeping
it's
the Zima.
It's valuable for us, you know.
The Zima's in.
The Zima's in. The bulleted lists in the tabular cargo pants description in what was over there is over here is a little bit different from your other stories, and I'm curious, was this a scenario in which you needed to shake up the form a little bit, or what happened here?
That was a story when I was running in sort of a more experimental phase, and so I sort of I was experimenting with lists, and I was experimenting with, you know, all sorts of sort of found documents that would make their way into the story. Originally that story was written all in like in photo captions.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it was really annoying. I actually really liked it. My editor, she's like, you either have to cut this or you have to fix it because it's incredibly annoying to read. And I could see her point. It was really annoying to read, you know, 5 pages of photo captions. Although, you know, you can see where that would sort of fit with the story since it's a photographer. So I changed it. And I feel like it still has that feeling of, it's a different style. It's got a very short declarative sentences. It's almost like photo captions, but a lot easier to read. And I really liked the list of things in his pockets. And I thought it would be, I think it's more interesting than saying what's in his pockets.
Yeah.
You know? And I think it actually reveals a lot about his character since, you know.
I have to ask about Good Shabbos. Because the thing about that story is that I read this, and it seemed to me to end almost abruptly for me. I mean, it was like, it was almost too short. And I'm curious if this had been in any longer form at any point, or why it kind of just chopped off. I mean, you're almost asking the reader to I suppose, speculate upon this dilemma of trying to adjust to this particular Shabbos. But it was the most abrupt ending of all the stories in the book. So I'm curious as to why that was.
To me, I felt like the character had undergone the change she needed to undergo for the story to end. But maybe that's not the feeling the reader gets from that. You know, to me, she had to sort of, and this is actually, that's a story that actually happened to me almost.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, I was teaching English in France, and it was a Hanukkah dinner in real life. I changed to Shabbat dinner, so, you know, you can tell I'm really milking the fiction for all it's worth. But the idea that the character sort of, you know, walking to the dinner with an idea of who she is as, you know, as a Jew and as an American, and coming away from that dinner with a sort of a completely different view, or just realizing that her view needs to be revised. And so that I felt like the character had undergone that transformation, and then I could stop the story. But perhaps.
I mean, you could have gone further. I genuinely believe that.
You don't want a story that ends so abruptly that it feels unresolved. But at the same time, I really like to stop a sentence ahead of the conclusion of a story because I really want, you know, I like when the reader, when not everything's all, the I's aren't dotted and nothing's tied into a bow, and the reader has to do a little bit of work to sort of find out. Think about where the character is going from here.
Did any of these stories come from the two novels that are sitting underneath your bed or wherever they are sitting at all? Were these efforts to re-explore certain themes? I mean, you know, you're writing like some 70 to 100,000 word novel. I mean, certainly it's got to be a bit of a bummer that it didn't get accepted and you maybe want to, I suppose, galvanize this again or re-explore a particular theme in a story or whatnot.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that these are all the themes that are in this book are things that I'm thinking about and struggling with, you know, and they're finding expression through fiction. And so in that sense, I don't think that the novels have really deviated so much from that. But they obviously are very different situations. For a while, there was a chapter from the Oklahoma Jew book, as it's known, was in the collection as a short story because that's been published as a standalone story. But because it's historical fiction, it really just did not fit in the collection. And it skewed the collection in a way that made it, you know, even though the collection's not very tightly grouped around a theme, but I feel like it does have thematic unity in a way that this story just didn't fit in that.
What was the criteria for for story selection?
It was what my editor wanted. No, but in some ways, I did not have a really good sense of what the collection should look like as a whole. And I think that might have been, as I've mentioned in an essay, that might have been why the collection like kept getting runner up in contests and not winning them, because I feel like it wasn't necessarily a coherent collection. Like people liked the individual stories, and but didn't feel like it sort of cohered together. And that's why Gina Frangello, my editor, was so incredibly helpful with what stayed and what went, and also the ordering of the stories. You know, she was able to articulate for me why she thought a story didn't necessarily belong in this collection. And the only one we ever sort of, there were two stories we, I mean, I was going to say discuss. We didn't even, you know, it wasn't even a fight to keep them because I value her opinion so much. But one of them was what was over there was over here, because she found the writing so unreadable. And I actually agreed with her once she pointed that out. And then the other one was The People You Know Best, which used to be a very different story.
How did that change? I'm curious.
I pretty much threw all of it out except for the fact that she was a Cyberotica writer, and I started again.
Interesting. Yeah. What was the original story like?
It was about a woman whose boyfriend kept pushing her out of bed at night by accident, and then they end up going to a literary conference. The one thing is that, and then she sort of begins to fantasize about a romance novel.
So it needed to be out of the literary field, it seems to me, and more into the real world, more into like the cop and all that.
It just wasn't a very wise story, if that makes sense. I wrote it a while ago. It just wasn't, it didn't feel like it touched on anything bigger than itself, and it just wasn't very good, to be honest. But I was able to rescue the erotica from my first novel. Had a romance novel within it. It was a novel within the novel.
So I
stole that. I changed the not so offensive terms for genitalia into offensive terms for genitalia, and it became erotica.
Interesting. Have you written other erotica? I wanted to ask.
I have not. That's been a popular question on the book tour circuit, but I have not.
An obvious one, but.
And I don't know if it pays as well as I say it does in the book, but if it does, if you're any erotica editors out there, I'd be happy to.
Maybe that's how writers are going to survive in the future.
Who knows, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, Allison, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks so much for talking with me.